session number 26354, Reel 2.
Carry on.
After I'd been there a day, it came through that I was being promoted to be a corporal. Not a lance corporal, but two stripes straight away. I thought, oh, this can't be bad. And of course, you get extra money for that. And of course, another thing in the army, obviously I forgot to mention, once I got married, my income doubled because my wife got the same amount as what I got.
Right.
You wouldn't, eh?
Did she have a job as well?
Not when I knew her. She had been, prior to me meeting her, she had been in the land army. Down on the Romney Marsh, which is a bleak place, helping the farmers down there to plant cabbages and leeks and anything like that. You know what I mean? Backbreaking job. But she was invalided out of that because she caught pneumonia.
Right.
So she was then allowed to be at home, and as her parents were civilian people looking after soldiers, and there was eight of us in the house.
That's a house full.
Pardon?
That's a house full.
You're telling me. There was eight of us in the house. If I said that these days we shared a bed, two blokes shared a bed, you'd think the wrong things. But in those days, you slept where you were told to sleep, and there was no hanky-panky, but I'll put it that way, you know what I mean? So we had double beds, all of us, right up in the... Well, there's three floors, you know.
Did the family get double rations because they were looking after
soldiers? Oh, they got special rations, oh yes, yes. And on top of that, the house next door was an officer's mess. And they got little perks from... Because officers have a tendency to like young girls, don't they? Yes, she said.
Yes.
And, of course, they were tempting the two daughters, my girlfriend, when I first went there, and her sister. They were being tempted all the time by a tin of corned beef or this, that, the other. You know what I mean? They didn't get any luck, but that's the position it was in those days. Now, we were in Italy, and somehow I got back to Folkestone. Barry. I was posted to the Remy Inspectorate with two stripes, which gave me a bigger income, which wasn't a lot, because when I joined up, 29th of January 1942, it was 2 and 6 pence a day, which is 12.5p. Now, that's not much over a week, is it? But the next day, they put the pay up to 3 shillings a day, which is 15p a day. Right?
Yes.
So, and of course, when I passed these courses as a vehicle mechanic and fitter, I got an extra 6 pence a day for that. And of course, when I got married, whatever I had, my wife had an equal amount. But I had to give half of my income to her as a voluntary allotment for her.
Right.
Now, when I was in Algiers, my wife was expecting our first child. And when she was 6 months pregnant, she was rushed to a hospital at Pembury in Tunbridge Wells. She was rushed to hospital because they thought that she was going to lose the child. She had massive hemorrhage and all that sort of thing. And they thought they were going to lose her as well. And I was told this by letter from her parents. And they said, could you see if you could get compassionate leave because there is a danger that we're not going to only lose the unborn baby, but we're going to lose Pat as well.
Yeah.
So I saw my commanding officer and I put it to him that I would like compassionate leave. What for? Well, my wife's expecting a baby, she's 6 months pregnant, and she's in hospital at the moment with very bad blood loss and all this, that, the other. And the doctors are afraid that she won't live. Look, soldier, if we gave every soldier whose wife is expecting a baby compassionate leave, we wouldn't be able to fight the war. No, you can't go. So I thanked him very much, and I went out dead furious. I was. I thought, excuse my language, I thought, sod this. I'm going to write to my MP about this, which you're allowed to do.
Who was your MP out of interest?
His name was Mackeson. Now, I don't know if he had a rank or what, but we called him Brigadier Mackeson, who was the of the brewing family in Hythe in Kent. Mackeson Stout was quite a competitor of Guinness. Very similar kind of drink. If anything, the Mackeson Stout was a milder beverage. No, very nice. I wrote to him anyway, put in the case to him, and he wrote, or sent my letter, to the War Minister, who was Lord Nathan of Chert. The next thing I knew is that I had a letter from Lord Nathan of Chert saying that my letter to my MP had been passed to him and that he was dealing with this situation. And as the same day, I think it was, that I got this letter from him, I got an order to report to the office. What's this about you writing to the War Minister? No, sir, I haven't written to the War Minister. Yes, you have. I've got a letter here from him. No, I've not written to him. I said, I've written to my MP, who passed my letter on to the War Minister, but I've not been in contact with the War Minister myself at all. You know you could be on a court-martial for this, don't you? I said, why is that? I asked you for compassionate leave and you refused me. And I'm so worried about my wife, I thought I'd entitled to write to my MP about it. And after a lot of humming and all, and they say, well, we'll let you off this time, but you're still not going home. And they made sure I did not get I think it was called Python, which was home leave for people abroad. I did get leave in addition to Python, LEAP, where I had an 8-day spell in Rome, you know, but that was just what they call a rest camp sort of thing. But I never did get home, and I was very, very bitter about that because my son was 17 months old before I set eyes on him at all, which was a long, long time, you know. Anyway, that's going ahead a bit too quick. Anyway, after a long spell in the 6th Equipment Assembly Company, Reamy Inspectorate, I was then posted to the 8th Royal Tank Regiment. And I thought, oh dear, somebody's caught up with me with Templar Barracks Tank Depot. So I reported to a place called Lake Bracciano, which was a lake about 10 or 20 miles north of Rome. And when we got there, it was the same sort of thing. On the lake side, which is the biggest lake, on the lakeside there was these tents, and I reported in to the Reamy captain there. He said, You've been sent to this tank regiment as Remy attached LAD, Light Aid Detachment. He said, we're going to go back to England to form up for the invasion of Japan. And my heart sank. I thought, invasion of Japan. So he said, now, as you've not had any home leave since you've been abroad, I can't force you to come. But on the other hand, if you volunteered to come with me, I'll give you another stripe. And of course, extra money, and it'll be extra money for your wife. And you can go home to England to see your boy. So, being young and stupid and only 21, I said, right, or 22 at that time, right, I'll go with you.
So what year was this?
Sorry?
What year was this?
1945.
Right.
At the time of the victory in Europe, which was the 8th of May 1945, because I was in this camp at Lake Draceno on VE Day. And we celebrated that by sitting outside the tent with a bottle of beer. One bottle. But anyway, we formed up to come back to Britain. And at the camp, they said, no, we're going to fly back to England and you have to lighten your loads. So anything that you haven't got that you weren't issued with, you must leave behind. Like if you had your own bed or anything like that, which I had got, because the first thing you do is to make yourself comfortable, you know, and a camp bed, especially an officer's throw-out camp bed, was a godsend.
How did you get hold of that?
From a dump.
Right.
You learn to improvise everything in the army in those days. You didn't miss a chance for anything. You with me?
Yes.
So, I thought, well, we got to get the weight down of what we got to carry. I can't remember the actual weight they said, but it was anything above that would be looked on with stern discipline.
Yeah.
Now, I shouldn't probably tell you this. You might edit this out. In my Remy Equipment Assembly Company days, I say naturally, with my tongue in my cheek, acquired a few tools. And I took them to Italy from North Africa. And I finished up with a good set of Canadian chrome vanadium ring spanners, double-ended spanners, a battery testing kit, and things like that, socket set. Which made my kit bag a little bit too heavy for this allowance that we had to take on the plane. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I decided, well, on this campsite, we had little pits where they dug down about 2 foot deep and burnt all the rubbish in. So I thought, well, I'll wrap these spanners up, clear out one of these pits, and bury the spanners down there so that I'm not breaking their rules by taking them with me on the plane, and I'm not stealing the spanners because I'm leaving them in a safe custody, which is what I did. And I suppose they might still be there to this day. To this day. But in the event, we didn't fly home, we came back by boat. to Marseille, or Toulouse rather, and then by train to Dieppe and back to New Haven.
What were the troop ships that you went on like? What was life aboard the troop ship like?
On that particular one from Naples to Toulouse was a blimmin' old tub called the Derbyshire. The Mediterranean can get awfully rough, rougher than the Atlantic Ocean actually, and it was like that. And of course it was overladen with troops to the extent that when we got to Toulouse, everybody went on to the starboard side to look as we were going into harbour to see what France was like, and the ship had a list of about that angle, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And we were told to get back on the other side before the ship went over, sort of thing. But no, that troop ship and the one we went from Algiers to Naples was a bit of a bucket compared with the Athlone Castle, which was a comparatively new liner. The Castle line did the from Southampton to South Africa run.
Yeah.
Right. So they were beautifully fitted out and all that sort of thing.
What was the discipline and the life in general like on the ships?
The discipline was strict. You had to keep to your no smoking at night, because a cigarette glow from a cigarette would show up if a periscope was, if a submarine was out there with a periscope about, and all that sort of thing, and rigid blackouts on the ship, so that you, when you went to your deck, you went through a, not an air chamber, but you went through those doors, we say, into here, and they had to be closed before you could open these doors.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the blackout wasn't ruined. And you had to practice every day boat stations in case of an emergency. You had to know where your boat station was. You had to wear life belts at all times, KPOC things which tucked under your chin there, tied around your waist, which had a little pencil light on the top, so that if you went over, they could theoretically see your distress light showing in the water. But I mean, thank goodness we never had to test the you know what I mean, the what would happen, because I'm positive in my own mind that if you were down in that dirty oily water after being torpedoed, a little light wouldn't show up very much at all. But anyway, that's but we were where?
Crossing over to Toulouse.
Yes, on the way back to England to form up. Now, when we got back to England, I was sent to a place called Arborfield on a tank recovery course, a week's course. And when I got to this place, it looked like this, actually. somewhere out here, somewhere, there's a big, in those days anyway, 1945, there's a big pit, and they had a Churchill tank down the bottom of this pit, and a Sherman tank in the depot, which had a, in the turret, had a big winch, a horizontal winch, instead of a, that way, it was that way, you know what I mean? So the whole turret was taken up by this massive winch. It had a dummy gun sticking out at that angle on the, say if the tank was going there, the dummy gun was out there. That was just a solid bit of metal.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And the idea was to get that tank that was down in this pit with the aid of ropes, pulleys, and the tank itself, being on the back of this Sherman tank was what they called a ground anchor, which is a big swivel thing which you put down reversed the engines onto this thing so that the thing went into the ground and made a good anchor. And then you hooked everything up after you had 8 different pulleys and double pulleys and all that sort of thing. You hooked it up to the winch on the tank and it came out just like the lump, as I say, cheese out of a package, you know, it just slid out. What you people here didn't tell me at the time, and I didn't take any notice of, and it's only since I've been in my dotage, put it that way, I thought, well, what a stupid thing I'd volunteered for. What were the Japanese going to do while I was up in the front line trying to get a tank out of trouble? They were going to be shooting at me like mad, weren't they?
Yeah.
So there again, luckily for me, while we were in England, the VE Day came along because the Americans dropped the atom bomb. So at the expense of 214,000 poor Japanese people, I probably got saved from being killed.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So, you were a sergeant by now, so what was the sergeant's mess like at Arbourfield?
I didn't have a sergeant's mess at
Arbourfield. Oh,
right. What was your accommodation like then? If my memory serves me right, somewhere near the stationing in Reading, I was in a civvy house there.
Right.
Right, for this week. I do remember, although I was married, I do remember there was a young girl there and she took one look at me and she said, oh, you're the splitting image of David Niven. Do you know him at all, the film star?
Yeah.
Well, in those days, apparently everybody told me I looked like David Niven. You know, which, unfortunately, didn't get me any girls. Because I was already married anyway. But no, I had a week's course here, but I was in civvy billets in somewhere near the station in Reading. That's all I do know. But when this fell through going to the invasion of Japan, at that time there was a bit of trouble in Austria and Hungary. There was a bit of trouble on the border between the two because Hungary was Russian troops and Austria was British troops, right? And never the twain should meet. So we got posted to Austria with headquarters at Graz, and my company of the tank regiment, still with the tanks, was posted to a little village called Gleisdorf, which is 2 miles from the Hungarian actual border. And we were told, on no account, go down the road towards the Hungarian border, because if you step one step over there, you would be shot. Right?
Right.
And this was now spring in 1946, and it was decided to show our strength to the Russians and the Yugoslav people that we would go down on May Day in Trieste to join a big not a procession, but a show of military strength. Tanks, like the you've seen, probably the ones in Moscow where they have all these big parades in Red Square. Well, it's the same sort of thing in Trieste. And we had our best tanks, which in those days was only the Churchill tank, which is a load of rubbish, really. But we showed our strength there. And from there, we were posted to Egypt, out in the desert. which was tense again. And from there we went up to Palestine, near the Gaza Strip, a place called Rafah, just to keep the peace between, because we're talking about now the people, although the state of Israel wasn't formed until 1947, but in late 46, there was a lot of Jews, or what were the Hebrews, come into Palestine illegally, and a certain amount legally, and setting up homes there, you know. But we were like a buffer state between the Palestinians who were confined to the Gaza Strip and the Jews.
So what was your actual role there then?
I don't really know what the actual role was, but I know we were there, and with the tanks and all that sort of thing, I suppose, had there been a bit of a skirmish, we would have been on one side or the other. I don't know. I never did bother to ask, because, I mean, you don't ask things like that. You accept the fact that you're there, and you make the best of it, because it's all sand desert, you know. There was no vegetation around at all. We were at the end of a camel train route. You could see the camels from miles away coming towards you, and when they got to you, it was about 20 camels strung out with all their things on their backs and all that sort of thing, and they were heading for Gaza town. That's all I know, you know. But it was all near the Egyptian border, and also separating the Gaza Strip from what eventually was to become Israel. You know. I was lucky enough when I was there to have another spot of leave, and I went to Jerusalem and did all the things in Jerusalem, the walk of the red, the blood. What do they call it? The Via Rosso, you know, where Christ walked up to Calvary with his cross on his back. I visited the Wailing Wall, and I went to the Mosque of Omar, which is near there. I saw several things in Jerusalem, you know, but being young, 23 I was then, that sort of thing didn't really interest me. In hindsight, I wish I did more. I went to the place where the Holy Sepulchre and all that sort of thing, where you're supposed to bury. But it was all inside a big church now. You know, it's not like you read in the Bible, the Garden of Gethsemane and all that sort of thing. But I did what was most tourists would have done if they went to Jerusalem, you know.
Yeah.
And from there I was demobbed. Came back to Old Woking. Do you know where Old Woking is? It must be a part of Woking's town somewhere.
I don't know Woking, no.
No. But anyway, that was a demob centre, where we handed in one uniform for another uniform, because 99.9% of the clothes issued there was pinstripe suits. But I was lucky in one way, that I got there late in the afternoon and all the pinstripe suits had gone, or most of them anyway, and I didn't fancy what I saw. But I did see a nice grey, plain grey, double-breasted suit, and it was a light grey. It wasn't a dark grey, it was a light grey. And I thought, well, that looks better than those pinstripe uniforms that the other blokes are picking up. So I had one of those, and I was quite pleased with that. Quite smart. Made by Burton's, it was. So a good name to have.
So how did you settle back into Sippy Street?
November 1946, this was. A prelude to the hardest winter that England has had for years and years and years. The snow was on the ground until April in Folkestone. I couldn't get a job because the only thing I had any experience of was when I left school at 14, I worked with my father, who was a builder. I worked with him for 2 years as an apprentice carpenter without any indentures, just word of mouth that he was going to train me to be a carpenter. Pardon me. But